G'day guys, welcome to this week's Hash It Out. I'm CW and joining me once again, we have Noah and Armenia. How are you guys?
Doing well.
Doing well. Yeah, it's a good week.
Hang on, I'll swap you
around. Depends on who you're asking.
Well, yeah, I guess not such a good week in the macro of crypto, but on this little planet of mine, it's going all right.
Good. Let's get into it.
Well, we've had a lot going on this past week. We might sort of kick things off on the Paxos and the BNB stable coin and the SEC sort of trying to strong hand them into compliance and all that sort of scenario. So let's sort of kick things off there and see where things take us, because there's a lot happened in this industry over the last sort of 5 days thereabouts. So let's hash that out.
All right.
Yeah, it was cracking as well with
I think that's the SEC. Place to start. Yeah. I think that's the place to start. Gary's on the march this week.
Yeah, yep. He sure is.
So yeah, he's had the printer going burr for all these legal notices. So unfortunately, Kraken was at the receiving end there. They copped their $30 million fine, and obviously if you've seen it around, there's a little video clip of actually Gary Holgazza being on the whatever news channel it was, just basically saying that all you have to do is just jump on and register. There's a form on the website. And and we all know that's a load of shit, but unfortunately, Kraken copped it.
Well, yeah, it's a honeypot. Like, that's a trap.
Yeah. Yeah, come in and speak to us. So yeah, we saw what happened with Libra and all that sort of thing. They try and go in there and then discuss things, but unfortunately, they were at the receiving end also of unfavorable sort of rulings. But yeah, with Kraken, the staking side and everything like that, it's pretty interesting, because I think it boils down to custodial staking or non-custodial staking, like liquid and unliquid. And I think on the Ethereum side, we all know there is a custodian of funds there for the validator themselves. Your funds are, like, you send my 32 ETH to Armenio's stake pool, and he takes custody of that and then rewards me. So that there is some sort of interpretation there of investment contract and things like that, as someone could sort of interpret. But yeah, it's an interesting point to sort of sit back and actually look at the industry and the state it's in at the moment.
Yeah, and for the Kraken SEC situation, to me it seems like a response to what we've seen with Celsius. To me it seems like they're targeting like large exchanges that act as intermediaries for lending and earn programs and staking and things like that. There's a conversation to be had about the SEC and proof of stake as a whole, but this specific action seems like it's not really targeting, you know, average Joe staking to a stake pool. You know, it's more targeting the large intermediaries.
Somewhat low-hanging fruit in a way.
Yeah.
Somewhat low-hanging fruit, where it's like, okay, they take a cut. You know, just that simple. that simple, they take a cut. And if, Kraken actually, I think, is a really pretty decent exchange, in terms of my experience with all of them. I think they run a pretty good business. But there's a lot of exchanges out there that are not in the U.S. that, I would say are much more capable of sketchy things. But, Kraken and, Coinbase at least try to play within the lines, but it seems like that line is shrinking on them a little bit.
That's unfortunately. That's the thing that I think a lot of people are actually frustrated with. And you could actually sort of hear that frustration in Jesse's tweet when he sort of responded to Gaz's little clip that I just mentioned a little bit earlier. And it's just basically along the lines of, yeah, it's that simple to go and register. And you have these companies like Coinbase and Kraken who are reaching out, trying to do the right thing, trying to be compliant and things like that. But it's a one-sided conversation. Like, they're trying to seek clarity and everything like that. And then they're just getting their asses handed to them with fine after fine, and just sort of regulation by enforcement, which is, I don't know, just stifling innovation, unfortunately.
Well, the welcome to the war, I guess. You know, what else can you say? It's going to be interesting moving forward, I think. We'll see. I think, you know, depending on how things progress this year, you know, crypto industry might look a little bit different than here in the future. It's still early, right? That's kind of the real interesting thing. It's still really early in terms of, you know, making any assumption of what things are going, but it scares the shit out of people.
Yeah, definitely. And ultimately, hopefully it brings people back around to first principles. Like, I know we just get on that drum and start beating it, but ultimately, like you said, like this is the state of the industry now. We know what's sort of coming. SEC's obviously shown their hand and the way they sort of want to bring about compliance. But ultimately, these systems are built to be resilient. They're built for war. They're built for the governments going after them, and we'll see what's actually a decentralized blockchain or if it's just a regular sort of system with without any decentralization. You've got centralized validators. There's no resilience between the platforms. Everyone just sort of bends over and takes what's sort of on offer there, because ultimately, why these systems have come about is to be able to be P2P sort of systems, and ultimately empower the everyday person, not centralized intermediaries or governments and anything like that. It's just dispersing power as much as we could possibly can.
It's pretty interesting. I know we've talked about a lot of these exchanges will have their own like blockchain sort of products. And you know, we've discussed how that is pretty sketchy, but in this case, it's like, if you have governments trying to sort of shut down pieces of your business, like I would be getting the fuck out of any like Binance Smart Chain or Huobi Chain. Like that's just, I don't know. At this point, it seems very tenuous to me.
No, one thing to remember though is you know, Kraken exists within the SEC's jurisdiction.
Right. That's
they're trying to play ball in the US, and the US, you know, doesn't quite have the same rules as something like Huobi or Binance is right. Exposed to, right? So in a way, the potential there is to really remove a large section of the user base in the United States from blockchain. Make that it's you, Noah. You're the one that's in trouble. CW is fine over there in Australia. You can do whatever he wants. Me, I can run a VPN, right? I'll go to Trade Ogre. I'll figure it out.
Yeah, you two are in a world of hurt, unfortunately. But we all sort of know it's coming at some point in time, and there's been some discussion about the ECB side of things as well, like the European central banks, sort of the way they want to approach this sort of stuff. And the rhetoric, the initial sort of rhetoric that's kind of going around and draft policy and legislation and things like that, it's still along the lines of this SEC things as well. So that's another big economic region that could be coming under the same sort of strong-handed tactics as we're sort of seeing here or there in America at the moment.
I think it was a month ago. I was like, yeah, I don't know if we'll see regulation in the next year. I'm eating my words. So
6 weeks in.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Oh, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh. It's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, just to go on, like elaborate more on the staking side of things. Obviously, Brian heard the little rumor about actually sort of bringing this regulation in, and they've got a lot of funds at stake also, because running a validator and their investment there, it's something along 10 or 11% or something of their actual yearly revenue stream. So there's a big financial sort of impact on another exchange who hasn't even hasn't copped this strong-handed sort of tactic at the moment, unfortunately, or fortunate for them. But yeah, Coinbase as well.
Coinbase, yeah. You're talking about, yeah, I was thinking about that too.
Go for it now.
No, you go this time.
Oh, I was just going to say, from a first principles perspective, we can't be surprised that a system that is made to remove intermediaries and empower P2P transactions isn't really favored by intermediaries and third parties.
Yeah.
Like that shouldn't come as a shock.
No, well, my personal take, we all knew it was coming. It's just a matter of when. There's always been that, the speculation and things like that. There's always been talk about regulation and things like that for the last X amount of years, 5+ years sort of thing, or even earlier, 2012, 2013, that's kind of started kicking off. I remember hearing about it then. But now we're actually seeing enforcement of a number of things. Like, this is just talking about staking, but also like the Paxos said in the stablecoin front as well, where you've got an actual legal entity that is under the jurisdiction of a financial regulator in New York. And obviously they would have had to have done audits and compliance and all that sort of stuff to be able to sort of meet sort of auditing sort of the aspects of their industry. And obviously now we've just seen sort of the SEC's ruling, or that the letter that they've actually provided the Paxos team, and about their intention to sue and all that sort of side of it. So yeah, it's a pretty interesting time in the industry currently.
Yeah, who knows about how that goes? I mean, most centralized stablecoin providers back their reserves with yield-bearing treasuries, right? Which, yeah, there were other securities potentially, right? So if you have something that is backed by securities and then you create a derivative on top of something that's backed by securities, is it a security? I don't know. Ask the legal department.
Wouldn't then, you know, Tether be in the same sort of situation then?
You know, that's a really basic question. I mean, if it is backed by like a reserve of securities,
yeah,
and then you create a derivative on top of a reserve of securities, is that a security? Well, I mean, I don't know. Luckily, that's not my problem, right?
Yeah,
actually, remember.
In a way, it is, because of course, you know, we all have stablecoin exposure in this industry. But yeah, let's see.
Yeah, I remember reading something. I can't exactly remember where it was or anything like that, but something along the regulation side for centralized stablecoins and what they can actually offer, and then what they can actually purchase as a reserve as well. And it's something along the lines, it has to be US currency, so hard currency, and treasuries and bonds and things like that. So it has to be backed by, I think it was 3 or 4 things. I can't remember exactly what it was off the top of my head. So there was a report that Paxos said that they were compliant. They released the numbers of, or the breakdown of what their actual reserves held in that sort of side of it. But yeah, it's pretty interesting to see that. And on face value, then you've got to take their word that is what actually is backing their reserves. And it's interesting to see on that front also that where Tether has actually lost a court ruling about trying to hide their reserve percentages or what was backing their stable coin. I think it was from the 2020 audit, the 2021 audit. I can't remember what it was, just off the top of my head. But yeah, there's a lot going on. It's pretty interesting.
No, there's always been an attack vector there, in my opinion. You know, whether it's being deemed a security or whether it's some sort of financial transmission issue, or, you know, who knows, even, you know, it's, I guess if you're going to create some synthetic derivative of a currency that has legal requirements to send, you know, do they extend to that synthetic version? And yeah, you just get into a legal, don't know, fog that, you know, I guess part of our industry is there, and good luck.
Yeah, on that legal side, it all comes down to terminology and
how
things are interpreted and all that sort of stuff. And I could read one paragraph and interpret it completely different to the way you two do as well. And yeah, it's just the way they make their arguments in court to see which one stands up with the strongest case. So yeah, we'll just have to wait and see all this to play out. But yeah, just on the Paxos front, there's what are they up there, like 10 billion plus, I think, on their market cap. So there's quite a lot of money at stake.
Yeah, there's a lot of coin there.
I think more than just the, you know, Paxos is one entity, I think it's more about the precedent that it could set. And that has larger implications and the industry as a whole. You know, we'll see how the next year looks, like you said, Joe.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this happened, you know, right now I'm kind of playing around with SIGUSD and the Ergo hack, you know, thing. And, you know, this happening, I guess it shows the need for more decentralized stores of value. I don't know if a stable coin is even like the perfect thing to shoot for. Maybe it's something that, you know, can always purchase a certain range of assets that kind of stores that in some value form. I'm not sure. But, you know, me personally, I've always been a little bit skeptical of centralized stable coins. Just because of the risks that they pose. And, you know, I think that, you know, not only like the regulatory risk, but there's also a certain like adoption and then pressure to towards compliance of a certain regime based on, you know, the adoption of certain stable coins. So it's something to watch. You know, long term, it could have a lot of implications in terms of governance and directions that systems take.
Yeah, it's... I've been thinking about all of this stuff all week, and just the question that I've been thinking about the most is, you know, once some of these doors are open, where is the line drawn? You know, it's like what I was just saying about precedent and, you know, when it comes to like SIGUSD as an example, like we saw some crazy shit going on with Tornado Cash. Like, will we start seeing crackdowns on DeFi, more like decentralized stable coins, and or like, you know, DeFi projects that are doing synthetics, like Indigo Protocol on Cardano? I know they're based in the U.S. Like, I would be shitting myself if I was them, but I don't know. It's there's just a lot of uncertainty now, and because there's no clarity, it's like the best thing we can do is guess and wait for Gary to send a letter.
Yeah, I mean, that's unfortunately kind of the case in some things. You know, one thing nice about Ergo is currently we have no direct exposure in the U.S. Well, you got me. I mean, okay, I could disappear, right? That might be a problem for the foundation, but CW would figure it out, right? You guys are capable. You don't really need me. You know, beyond that, I mean, you know, whatever happens in U.S. jurisdiction, U.S. exchanges, okay, and that's kind of for exchanges that, you know, list assets that might be an issue. For us, we're not there yet. You know, and maybe this is good for us in terms of opening markets. And I don't know. I think that proof of work is at least a higher fruit up the tree if you're talking about things that you're going to try to control. You know, especially a proof of work project that really has no market exposure directly in the U.S. You know, I think we can kind of sit back and watch. And, you know, users, okay, you know, they'll probably have to move their coins around if they want to interact with Ergo like they have, you know, currently. They have to, you know, go to KuCoin or go to CoinEx or go to Huobi or some exchange that isn't in the U.S. jurisdiction. And maybe with Rosenbridge, we'll have, you know, more decentralized options to where somebody can, you know, buy an asset, you know, let's say from an exchange and then, you know, wrap it, move it to Ergo and bada boom, bada bing, you're in the ecosystem, right? We'll see. I think that certainly it's something that we can sit back and watch for a while. And I do think that, you know, aside from like the energy FUD around proof of work, you know, in terms of legislating it as a decentralized system, that's hard to do because then you'd have to go after Bitcoin because we really have, you know, very similar assumptions there. you know, and in terms of energy use, okay, China's tried to ban proof of work a couple of times. How's that working out? You know, what are they going to do? Come at your door and knock and say, excuse me, are you running one of those GPUs in your house? And you're like, yeah, but it's in my computer. Well, what are you doing on your computer running that GPU, you know?
Playing games.
Good luck. Yeah, good luck is all I got to say. Good luck.
Yeah.
Ethereum going to proof of stake was almost... I feel like the energy FUD is less likely to be a hot conversation just because Bitcoin is kind of so ubiquitous. Whereas, you know, with Ethereum, there's like all the NFT stuff and DeFi and people can say, oh, that's all unnecessary. But maybe it'll take some of the heat off of the the energy FUD.
I don't know. I mean, as soon as that, how long did it take before, you know, OFAC compliant block producers popped up? And we saw a rapid shift in kind of the culture. And, you know, to some degree that directly is correlated to potential legislation.
Yeah, it was near sort of instantaneous. It was
fast. Shocked me.
There was even no sort of discussion. It just kind of popped up and it's like, I don't know, round number 10 of the 16 validators are now OFAC compliant, and then all of a sudden block production was up around 100% OFAC compliant, and ultimately it kind of turns into a permission system and all that sort of stuff then at that point. But it's an interesting take, because what happens then, like, I think it might have been mentioning, like, looking at Coinbase, obviously they've got a large staker sort of people delegating to them to Coinbase and their validation services and things. And if they then are deemed or having to close down their validator, what then happens to people's funds that are locked up and everything like that? Like, because it is illiquid staking.
Yeah, I think I saw something that Kraken is just going to sort of like hang on to it. And then you'll get it back. So it's like one of those trust me, bro kind of situations.
I guess there is no exit strategy built in at the moment.
No,
you're TM soon. Stuck.
Yeah. I do want to say on the OFAC compliance thing on Ethereum, it's kind of interesting on MevWatch. They've got all these charts about block production and all that. It seems like the OFAC compliance is like slowly trending downward from the peak. And I wonder, you know, it's impossible. We can only guess, but I wonder if there was some fear of like immediate sort of legislation against, you know, whatever.
I think it was just infrastructure.
It'll be an interesting trend to watch if it continues downward or if it goes back upward.
Yeah, I think it was infrastructure related in Ethereum's case. You know, the real question you have to ask when that happens, because, you know, you can say, oh, you're censoring transactions. And then people say, well, no, technically, eventually they'll settle. Right. But the reality is when you're talking about kind of P2P trading on a blockchain, it's all about races, essentially. Yeah. It's race conditions. Who can race to get included into a block first? And you know, maybe they pay more to get included. But that's ultimately a huge part of kind of the economic game theory of trading on blockchain is, you know, how do you race to get your transaction in a block? And if you're censoring certain parts of the world, you have now created a tiered economic system where, you know, if Noah's in a jurisdiction that, you know, sorry, buddy, this block is, you know, OFAC compliant and you have to wait. Well, guess what? Now people that are able to transact in that block can front run Noah. So he's at an economic disadvantage to people, you know, that have that permission. So, you know, I think that long term, that's probably one of the most important questions we need to ask in terms of the design of these systems is, do we want to kind of be like, I guess, Web3 net neutral, where, you know, we let anybody from anywhere have equal access to block space, Or are we going to create some kind of tiered or federated system to where one, you know, jurisdiction or one group of people is going to have essentially an advantage, a trade advantage?
It's interesting. Just today on the radio, I was listening to a conversation about Syria and all of the earthquakes that happened in, or the earthquake that happened in Turkey and Syria. And, you know, people are wanting to send aid to their families, but because of sanctions, they're not able to do so.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of geopolitical games that, you know, it's like from the official government message, you know, there's one thing, but then on the other side, there's just people on the ground. There's people with families. There's people that need to eat. There's people that need to try to produce and make money and keep a roof over their heads and keep the lights on and live. Right. Mm-hmm. And the reality is those are usually the characters that would benefit the most from a system that is actually net neutral, because they're the ones that are currently punished primarily because of the sanctions that are in place or the restrictions in trade. And, you know, you have to ask the question, if we just replicate the same system, how are we going to, you know, actually be useful?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So I don't know. I'm a big advocate for keeping like block inclusion net neutral. And then if you want to do business, Noah, you do it in your application, right? You can run that type of compliance on the application level. Keep it away from block inclusion, because as soon as you do, you've just, in essence, you know, disrupted one of the most valuable assets of these systems, and that's the neutrality of it. Yeah. You know, you can look at it. You can look at an example. What some of the countries with the highest adoption rate? It's like Nigeria, right? It's countries where they need better financial infrastructure. They need greater access. So I really think that's the wrong move. Even in Ethereum side, like, okay, you can get Polygon to run your fucking Happy Meal NFT. Great. You know, good for you. But I really think we can do better things with these systems.
Oh, shit. Fucking hell. I can just, I can just picture it. Opening up your Happy Meal and you got a dick butt in there. But you mentioned Nigeria. That's a pretty nice sort of example there, because even the Nigerians, they're actually paying a premium to be able to operate in this, in say Bitcoin, for example. So obviously spot value, I don't know what it is, 20 something thousand at the moment, and they're upwards of 40 something thousand. Like, they're happy to pay that so they can opt out of the, I don't know, the CNBC Nigerian sort of thing that they're trying to implement there, and their restrictions on cash and everything there as well. So it's providing power and the ability for people, everyday people, just to be able to sort of operate in economic environments where they're kind of excluded. And we don't want to go down that path where, like you mentioned, we don't want a federated system where a lot of people are excluded from fair systems.
You want neutral race conditions to the block. That's what I would call it. And the reality is, the current state of the game, more often than not, is just it's a feed system. But guess what? At least that universally applies to everybody. It's in the, you know, miners' incentive to just mine what's the most profitable, what's going to pay them. So at least everybody has the same game. But, you know, when you start to influence block inclusion, you know, it's kind of like, okay, well, you can ride the bus, but you're in the back. Yeah, you know, that's not what we want to do. I would hope.
So
sometimes I don't know while looking at some of the shit that goes on in this space, but I would hope.
What's preventing, like, let's say there's some new law tomorrow that mining pools in the United States have to KYC their miners?
Well, you know, they would have a mass exodus, most likely.
How would that be different from, I don't know, like on Cardano, there's a big debate right now about the real question
isn't even like whether an SPO can permission stakers. I don't even think that's interesting as a question, to be honest. I think the secondary question is interesting in terms of block inclusion, right? Like, okay, in worst case, you know, Cardano goes down that path with their, you know, governance stuff, which I have no idea where that even is at, because, you know, it's another system. But, you know, worst case, they get some sort of OFAC compliance and then they're Ethereum. I mean, you know, that's Ethereum's already doing that.
Right.
Sadly. Yeah. You know, I can actually speak on this issue like with firsthand experience, because it's something I have, well, like personal experience with. I went to Rare Bloom in Denver, which is like a Cardano festival. And, you know, they had a lot of different projects and stuff. I actually had lunch with Charles there and he was looking on his phone, and that was right after the merge. You know, Dan's there, so it was a nice chance to kind of hang out. And he was looking at the, you know, OFAC compliant pools on Ethereum and what the percentage was. And he was kind of shaking his head saying, this is wild, you know, how it came up so quickly. So, you know, from my experience, that's where I saw his head at anyway. So I people get emotional and a little bit, I don't know, dramatic. Now that is it's crypto, baby. Now that is a fundamentally good question to discuss, in my opinion, like the design of these systems. Like if you're going to create a base layer that has unequal access, what are the implications of that? You know, and then if you're going to try to build business on top of that, you're certainly going to have to focus in the jurisdictions that have a natural advantage. You know, you're going to have to build towards that market, you know, and I guess some will do that, some won't. I don't really give a shit because, well, I'm in the Urgo project, right? And that isn't really something that I hear much about. I think our miners would probably just mine to a different pool.
Yeah, well, obviously there'll be some limitations, I guess, around servers, and that then sort of ties into ping time and the availability that they do have then into sort of that decentralized infrastructure. But
well, one thing we have to keep in mind too, right now, at least on Ergo, is that for the most part, you know, block space is not such a scarce commodity, right? Like the congestion isn't to the point where if you just decide to censor a certain number of transactions, you know, you're cutting your revenue rather than having some replacement there immediately. So it doesn't even really make sense for them to do that on Ergo yet, because as soon as they do, there's an economic incentive for people that can provide or like include all of the transactions in the block. Mm-hmm. And in a way, they would just be pushing those transactions to other pools who would make more money. So there's somewhat of an economic incentive there at play. Yeah. And the same thing is true when you get into the fee market, right? To where if you're a mining pool and you're including transactions based on the fee that's attached, you would probably lose money. Yeah. You'd probably lose more available, you know, kind of block share and revenue by making that choice, which doesn't make sense. You know, it's actually one of the, I would say, potential positive things about a fee market, is that at least it's universal and it creates an incentive not to censor transactions, rather to just allow economic value to determine priority.
That's another interesting point also to consider, and around the miner governance and the control of the parameters they have. And if there, we do reach that congestion point, then block size can be sort of increased just on a simple majority. And obviously then, once again, sort of taking the power away from those pools who are trying to force that compliance and things like that. And yeah, it's just a matter of redirecting the miners into sort of something that is located in a different jurisdiction outside of the US. So
I really do think that just the economic argument there wins. Like if I were to say, hey, no, I'm going to compete against you, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to cut some of my revenue and I'm going to pass it to you. Because that's essentially what you'd be doing if you cut out a profitable aspect of the fee market, is you're just passing that revenue to your competitor.
How is that different from, and this is like a good faith question. Like, how is that different from what's going on with Ethereum pools currently?
Well, right. It kind of is happening. But the nice thing about Ethereum is that there is enough value to include in blocks that it's not that large of an issue. And I get what you're saying. Yeah, and then
there's just going to be more transactions that are queued up, ready to.
Yeah, I mean, like if you send a non-OFAC compliant transaction, it will still settle at some point. But the reality is, there's enough economic activity and incentives being thrown around that it's not that much of a loss to, you know, push it down the chain a little bit. Versus if you have a system that is newer and, you know, you don't always even have full blocks, it really makes no sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And plus, something also to be mindful of is like just general market condition as well, because all this has come about when we've been in a downturn as well. So it hasn't been that hype and speculative sort of assets where people are trying to do NFT minting and redemptions and all kinds of things, where the market's running really hot and people want to sort of get in and out, and the race conditions are a priority for a lot of people. And you can see that with the gas side on Ethereum. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how then the non-OPEC compliant transactions do then stack up when the market is actually running hot, and how long does it take for them to be included into blocks.
It'll show up. I mean, if it stays at a majority, at some point it'll show up when race conditions emerge. You're going to get that tiered system. You know, okay, maybe markets right now are, you know, not as hot. So, you know, it still happens. I'm sure it still happens where, you know, people have a good trade and instead they get put in the back seat and somebody else steps in front of them in the chain. But, you know, I do think that when you're actually in more hot conditions where you have a lot of people racing for the same assets, or you have, you know, that type of, I guess, congestion and competition, it'll really show up. Yeah. And then it will push a certain value and community, you know, into certain jurisdictions.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. And then, like, on the Ethereum side, you do have their liquid staking sort of side of it as well. And I believe, is it the Shanghai hard fork that they're going to bring in, which then brings a little bit more sort of like liquidity to the staking side of their protocol. And to see the difference then on, I guess, the way that the word salad will come out of regulation and things, and having a blanket statement of proof of stake, they'd take Ethereum basically as the benchmark and then put that blanket over all proof of stake protocols. And like we know, Cardano's different. Like, there's a number of different proof of stake protocols out there, but ultimately they're all going to be tarred with the same brush because of the way Ethereum's designed.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of nuances there that I'm not so sure regulators really care to dig into anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I guess if that worst case, if something like that happens, it's a good joke that the name of it was Shanghai, which is where you'd like you kidnap someone and throw them on a boat, right? The whole thing got Shanghai'd. Let's see. I mean, it's kind of dark humor, I guess, in this space, but what can you do? Let's see.
Yeah, so interesting times ahead. If someone was to be, say Noah Pool spins up and he wants to be OFAC compliant in the Ergo ecosystem, and there's a number of, say he has 5 terahash people mining for him, and he brings this news about, what do you think, what's a hypothetical sort of situation that you could see sort of unfolding on that front?
Well, I would hope that miners would leave, right? I mean, to some degree, it's like, okay, the beauty and the chaos of decentralized systems is that my opinion doesn't really matter. The question is, what will people do? Right? How will they respond? And, you know, it's one of those things, it's hard to predict, because, you know, I think, in a way, a lot of the times I just say 50-50. It depends on people's intent and their incentive.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what would be the incentives at play there? You know, some will go, some will stay, but
well, I think you, the larger incentive in our industry in terms of compliance is fear. It's not necessarily an economic one, although there is some people that will say, okay, well, if we comply and if we follow all the rules, the government's going to brace us with, you know, mass adoption, right? That's a field of thought. But, you know, in my opinion, the actual incentive in most cases is probably fear. And that's why, you know, you see discussions like this pop up after a news event that creates a lot of fear in people. Like, oh, you know, could this harm my economic position? And therefore, how can I, you know, adapt to that, make myself safe, right, my funds safe, my business safe, whatever. So, you know, in proof of work, it'd be like, okay, well, what if, you know, Gary says, oh, you know, everybody that's a miner is technically some sort of, you know, payment settlement provider, and they have to come in and get in line behind Kraken for, you know, the form.
Go on,
register. You know, they're... Yeah, there might be a lot of people out there that have invested a lot of their time, energy, money into mining, and they're scared. And so then that fear would push them towards, you know, compliance, because maybe if they can comply, all of that time, energy, money, value that they have is preserved. Mm-hmm. You know, I can understand it. I just think that in terms of like the long arc and net design and like first principle philosophy around crypto, we need to have base layers that are net neutral, that are truly global settlement systems that don't, you know, follow the same logic and restriction as existing financial powers. Because the reality is, like, a lot of the places that would benefit the most from, you know, actual decentralized ecosystem and access to broader economies are people in areas with financial issues that are oftentimes the ones that are sanctioned countries, because they have financial issues and madness and, you know, not always the greatest governments or organizations that run them. So I don't know. Yeah. We'll see.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That the comment there about proof of work and regulation there, compliance for the US, like, you see some big operators that actually move their farms into the US jurisdiction. When the China ban happened and things like that. So there's some really big operators that, like, sort of operating out of Texas and with favorable sort of energy costs and all that sort of stuff as well. So it'd be interesting to see how that then plays out, whether they pack up their infrastructure and move elsewhere or what happens.
Yeah, it's a broad political question. Everybody loves to be green until they get that power bill, right? And then they're like, hey, maybe we should lower the cost of energy by, you know, expanding the supply of it. And that's not necessarily green, but it's easier on the wallet and winner.
Yeah. So
that's why I say a lot of things, they break down to what's the intent and what's the incentive. So, you know, it's something that if it happens in Ergo, I know what I'll say.
Right? Yeah. And you know, before we jumped on this call, you mentioned, like, there is something along these lines that was in the Bitcoin community.
There actually was a Bitcoin pool, I think it was in 2019, maybe 2020, that was trying to, like, flirt around with this idea of, you know, compliant blocks. And, you know, the Bitcoin community kind of told them to go fuck themselves, which, respect. I agree with that. I don't think that's the way to go. I think that having a neutral base layer is foundational to actually have open global networks. Otherwise, you're just, you know, prioritizing one jurisdiction over another, and that's not good. That's the current system, right?
Yeah, it's like, what are we even doing all this for
at that point? I don't know. I can't answer that question, but maybe it's just the Happy Meal NFT and the moon.
You've got to protect the bags.
Yeah, that's really what it is. Yeah, I don't know. It's something that I think that the SEC will probably go after low-hanging fruit. I don't see us as low-hanging fruit, to be honest. And we're not in the jurisdiction directly. So, you know, in a way, that kind of is an interesting position just as like a network.
I guess as speculation, like, maybe we can... sort of think about what other low-hanging fruit might be next. You know, it's anyone's guess.
If you want, man, I'm sure some people are out there doing their analysis right now, putting in their longs and their shorts and all that good stuff.
Yeah, and all the trading aspect, I don't care about that. It's more just like
on off ramps.
Yeah,
the industry choke point.
Yeah, that's probably.
Yeah, true. It always has been. It always has been. You know, I think the exchanges, you know, just putting compliance, you know, within a jurisdiction is big. Then you have the ability to go after certain companies that are within a jurisdiction. And the reality is, I don't think it'll stop the technology. It'll just move it away from the US, or we'll see some sort of weird adoption in the US that is more specific to the US. You know, because then you just kind of cut out other markets due to the compliant factor. So maybe there's some, you know, adoption within like jurisdictions that are favored due to the race conditions, you know. So let's see.
Yeah, it's another point actually to raise that's happened this week, and it's the closing or the shutting down of local Bitcoins as well. So obviously one of the leaders there, and unfortunately it's sad to see that they've gone.
Yeah.
What can you give me like a TLDR of that one?
Basically, I think their little statement said there was something along the lines of market conditions, and they just can't sort of keep things running at the moment. And
what is local Bitcoins? I'm not familiar with that.
Basically, kind of like BISC sort of set up where you it's like a P2P feed exchange for Bitcoins and things like that, like local Monero and things like that. So it's one of the OGs, if not the OG, Bitcoin P2P sort of transfer setup system there for being able to sort of trade your assets. It's unfortunate to see an icon like that in the industry sort of go under as well.
Yeah. State of space. I mean, the reality is everybody tends to be a little overreactive, in my opinion. And I get it. Like, that's kind of like the trader mentality. Is if you can see into the future and prepare for it, you're more profitable and you'll avoid pain. But the reality is, a lot of this is just wait and see. You know, people make it bigger news than it absolutely has to be. You know, they went after Kraken. Well, if Kraken, you know, was making money there from their staking, you know, maybe that presents some kind of custodial ship. I don't know. Right. Yeah. Then you could look at Paxos and say, okay, well, if they have a stable coin that's backed by securities and they're building a derivative on top of securities, you know, maybe that looks like a security. That doesn't seem insane.
Yep.
So let's see.
Yep. Not wrong, mate. So we're coming up to time and we've kind of unpacked a lot. There's been a lot that's happened this week. Is there any sort of last words? I think you just sort of mentioned a couple there, Joe.
Yeah, I think the thing to remember is like, what control do you have over that? Right, a lot of the time when we plug into things, you know, you have to ask, okay, like what's the usefulness? And you know, to some degree, they're gonna do what they're gonna do. Gary's gonna do what he's gonna do. You know, the current political regime's gonna do what they're gonna do. The election's going to happen. You know, we'll see if that shifts sentiment at all. That'll be interesting to watch. Maybe we'll get some sort of crypto representation in the US. Maybe not. But, you know, in the short term, not much I can do about it other than kind of watch and talk to you guys.
That's right. I'll just say, if any of what we're trying to do with Ergo is for real, then, you know, most of this shouldn't affect us too much.
Yeah, I think that we should just start with that. Like, welcome to the Ergo ecosystem. We're striving for like net neutrality on the base layer, money for all people of the internet, and read the manifesto. And if you don't like it, there's a ton of other projects out there that, you know, probably fits your worldview. Fit what you'd like to do, and who knows, maybe, you know, you'll get that big X and I don't know, get a girlfriend and retire. whatever crypto traders are looking for these days. I don't know.
Happy meals.
UCW?
Yeah. Can't wait for one. I don't know. There's pretty significant figure here in the Ergo ecosystem, and basically their response was, oh, not specifically to these points, but basically along the lines of, so what? Just continue doing what we're doing. We're building these systems that are built to be resilient and everything like that. So ultimately, that's what we're here for, and just continue those values moving forward. Obviously, a guiding light there, like Joe mentioned, is the Ergo Manifesto. So if you haven't seen that, if you haven't seen it yet, by all means, jump on there and check that out. Just do a quick Google search for Ergo Manifesto, and it brings it straight up. All right, gents, it's been a pleasure chatting once again. There's a lot more that we could sort of continue with here, but let's wrap this up. And it's been a pleasure chatting once again.
Yeah, always.
Yep, see you next week.
See you guys. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Have a good one.